Hello and welcome to Behind News. My name is Doug Henwood, reporting from a rural corner of Gloucester, Massachusetts. You may even hear some birds in the background. First, in moments, George Joseph will tell us about how Teach for America is going global, to India in this case. And at the bottom of the hour, Adolf Reed will talk about left politics and the Sanders campaign. First, George Joseph. In 1989, Wendy Kopp wrote her Princeton undergraduate thesis that formed the basis for the group she founded with the help of some Wall Street and charter school types, which she dubbed Teach for America. Kopp was on the staff of a right-wing publication at Princeton, as my friend Corey Robin discovered, though now she keeps her politics carefully wrapped to maximize her appeal. TFA's mission is to recruit graduates of elite colleges, spend a few weeks training them, and unleash them on rural and urban schools attended by poor kids. They typically have no experience teaching and no ties to the worlds they're parachuted into. Their record is underwhelming, but elites love the model, in part because they're a lot cheaper than the unionized teachers that they often replace. Many TFA alums go on to Wall Street after a couple of years of teaching, but many also go on to work in education policy or to spread the gospel of entrepreneurship as the best cure for poverty. TFA alums have been extremely influential in shaping post-Katrina New Orleans. And now TFA has gone global. Here is George Joseph, author of an article in the July 18 issue of The Nation on Teach for India. Welcome, George. It looks like Teach for America is going global, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yep. All across the world. 5 continents except for Antarctica.
I guess the penguins are not ready for them. Yeah, you discovered this in an interesting way, right? Tell us how that happened.
Yeah, so I think it was sometime last year I was searching through WikiLeaks, just seeing if there was any random connections to Wendy Kopp and her new international education group, Teach for All. And interestingly, when you search Teach for All, what you find are several email correspondences between Teach for All officials and Asma al-Assad, that's Bashar al-Assad's wife, the wife of the bloody Syrian dictator. The emails from 2011 feature Asma al-Assad's spokespeople expressing interest in creating a Teach for Syria. And rather than questioning perhaps the clearly authoritarian nature of the regime, which had a very bloody track record even before the uprisings in Syria, Teach for All happily responded with a lot of promotional material, seemingly encouraged Asma to start a Teach for Syria. And so they had actually scheduled a planning meeting in 2011 for a Teach for Syria, but the Syrian uprising had actually started occurring at that time, and Assad was making headlines across the world for its bloody suppression of peaceful protesters at that time. And so that meeting had to be canceled. But it just really shocked me that Teach for All, Wendy Kopp's, that's the Teach for America Founders organization, was so willing to spread itself anywhere and anywhere that it would work for the Assad administration, even in the midst of this horrific suppression.
All right, so you've looked closely at what they've been up to in India. Before we talk about what TFI is up to itself, what did the Indian educational system look like going into TFI's arrival?
Like many developing countries around the world, and India is one with spectacular growth recently, the public education system has never really been funded properly. In the mid-60s, there was a famous commission called the Kothari Commission that had recommended that Indian education be funded at least 6.6% or something like that in order to actually develop a system in which most children would have access to primary education with proper class size ratios, bathrooms, the sort of things that you would expect from a bare bones educational system. Unfortunately, the Indian government, central government, has refused to ever do this. The most it came up to was 4.4%, I believe, under the Congress regime a few years ago, which is like the center-left party.
These are percentages of GDP you're talking about?
Yes, percentage of GDP. The results have been appalling. I mean, you just have so many schools where you don't have proper bathrooms, you don't have proper running water, teachers are teaching 50 students all by themselves. There's no school nurses, no clerical staff, so teachers are doing multiple jobs. On top of that, teachers are also expected to be election officials sometimes. So then you have huge problems of absenteeism because teachers are doing so many jobs, and the facilities they're going to are just horrible. And it's even worse in rural areas where you have one teacher teaching pretty much everyone in the village with no class differentiation or that type of thing. And so Indian public education has gone from, I mean, it wasn't great, but in the 70s, at least, a lot of people were going to government schools, to today's situation in which only the very poorest of the poor and lower caste people are going to these types of schools. So what we see is just a severe lack of ever funding proper development in Indian schools. And that's where TFI, with its unique model, comes in.
Yeah, now this, of course, is at odds with the images of India as, you know, the rising tech power and, you know, the call centers, but also the software, the engineering, all that. You know, this is the sort of thing you would think requires a highly educated population, but the government's commitment to that seems to be very limited to, what, the upper classes?
Yeah, I mean, since the late 80s, early 90s, with the so-called liberalization that took place, India has moved from a relatively robust state, just in terms of its willingness to actually engage in serious social uplift programs. That sort of spectacular economic growth that's often heralded hasn't necessarily benefited wide swaths of society in terms of providing basic social provisions like healthcare and education. And that is largely due to the fact that groups like the World Bank and the IMF encouraged countries like India and countries across the developing world to actually slash most of their healthcare and education spending programs throughout the 80s and 90s. So the results are that millions of students in India do not even have access to eighth grade currently.
Okay, and into this steps Wendy Kopp and her minions. How'd they get going?
After the incredible success that was Teach for America.
You're saying that with tongue firmly in cheek, right?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Teach for America has never been shown to advance anything except the career trajectories of its own fellows. And after significant backlash against that organization, Wendy Kopp decided, I guess, to move on to the rest of the world. And so they've rapidly expanded in only 6 or 7 years, I guess almost 10 years at this point, to 43 countries around the world. And every continent, as I mentioned, except for Antarctica. And the basic idea of the program is the same as Teach for America. You take the elite students, college students of their respective country, train them for a few weeks on how to be teachers, which is extremely inadequate, and then put them into the toughest schools in the country, theoretically, and then in a few years after they've gotten their taste of teaching and poverty and that type of thing, they go on to be transformational leaders that will change society. We're still waiting in America for that to happen, but yeah.
Yeah, the son of a friend of mine did Teach for America, and he's pursuing humane pursuits, but I think that seems to be exception and not the standard thing. It seems like they're more likely to go on to Goldman Sachs rather than uplift humanity.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them do go on to the corporate sector, but we probably shouldn't underestimate the extent of their influence in the world of education. In America, so many of the so-called education reform operatives who are pushing for the expansion of charter schools in urban school districts across the country or testing, over-testing of students come from the ranks of Teach for America. So while they may not have drastically improved the educational outcomes of students in the countries they operate, they do probably have a major role in the restructuring of educational systems. And we see that with the incredible growth of the charter school movement here.
We see D. Ray McKesson moving on to become the director of human capital in the Baltimore public school system, a very prominent example of that. The TFI fellows in India, are they all drawn from within India, or are they foreigners brought in as well?
Mostly they're drawn from India. They're usually top students from Indian colleges, although some of the fellows that I observed actually weren't from India. They were just people of Indian origin like me from out of the country. But regardless of where they're from, it's highly problematic because in India, every state you go to, there's different languages, and sometimes even within states, there are multiple languages. And so when they're attracting supposedly the best talent from across the country and placing them in random places, seemingly, you're having people who literally don't know the language of their own students sometimes, or know it very poorly. Can you imagine a situation in which your teacher barely understood what you were saying and vice versa as a young child, and they're supposed to all be teaching English to kids who literally don't know English often? It's a crazy situation.
I'm thinking of that. George Joseph, who has a piece in The Nation magazine about Teacher America going global with Teacher India. Stepping back a moment, getting back to the origin story of TFI, how did things get rolling? We've sort of lost that thread.
There's the official narrative, which is so it's so perfect, it's hard to imagine. Supposedly what happened was the founder of Teacher India, Shaheen Mistry, burst into Wendy Kopp's office in Midtown Manhattan all of a sudden and said, "I have to start a Teach for India and I need your help." And so from there, Wendy Kopp supposedly had a lot of reservations, but upon going on a tour of Mumbai with Mistry, realized the great need for her program that there was. And so there's this funny story where Wendy Kopp, Shaheen Mistry, the founder of Teach for India, and Anu Aga, one of her first big donors to the Teach for India project. She's a head of a big corporation in India called Thermax. They were walking around and they saw this poor guy with open wounds in his arms. And then all of a sudden, Aga realizes that she has to just donate hundreds of thousands of dollars to the organization. And Mistry is so moved because she realizes only in a place of such inequality could there be such generosity. That's a quote from her book.
These stories sound almost cult-like. I mean, the magical moments of insight and such.
Right. Like, I mean, Mistry first came up with the idea of being involved in education. She's actually from America. She studied at Tufts, and she went to private school in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is one of the most expensive private schools in the country. But anyway, she was visiting her family in Mumbai, and she just happened to be sitting in a cab, and she saw these three beggar children and had a flash where she realized that her future lay in helping the Indian poor. These are the sort of backgrounds where a lot of the Teach for India and Teach for All apparatus come from. But it often means that in terms of their understandings of what causes poverty or what major structural problems the poor face, they're sorely lacking in terms of their solutions.
And McKinsey was involved in creating TFI, right?
Yeah, so there's this funny moment where Shaheen Mistry, the founder of Teach for India, and one of her colleagues were disagreeing about whether Teach for India should be solely focused on education or a wider range of social issues. Well, this disagreement became so heated, apparently, according to her autobiography, that they did anything that us founders of a social movement, as Teach for India calls itself, would do. They called on McKinsey to sort out their differences. That's literally what they say in their autobiography. So then they go to McKinsey and they spend three arduous months working all night, all day to create this revolutionary new nonprofit. And what they come up with is exactly the same program as Teach for America. Send elite students for 5 to 7 weeks to this training camp, then send them to the poorest schools for a couple of years and see what happens. I would say the short-sightedness that we see here.
Okay, and then who funded the startup of TFI?
Well, as I mentioned, Anu Aga, this prominent corporate donor, was one of the big funders. But if you look at their donors, it's just a lot of the major corporations of India, tire companies, Goodrich, this industrial manufacturer. The list goes on and on. It's just like in Teach for America, where a lot of the major corporations of the day donate. And this is happening in each Teach for All site, where local corporations will be pitching in to donate. So in Germany, Lufthansa is a big sponsor, and they hire a lot of fellows after to work in their corporate divisions.
This really sounds like classic neoliberal corporate thinking, in that they're looking to some magic bullet to substitute for a generous public funding of you know, a sound educational system.
Mm-hmm. And I think it goes deeper than that, because a lot of research in social science world has shown that it's not even funding schools properly that fixes education. It's really more funding society and attacking inequality that generates better educational outcomes. So the neoliberal delusion is that if we just fund or improve education, at this point they're not even willing to fund it, then we'll fix all of society's other ills. And that's actually something that Shaheen Mistry, the founder of TFI, explicitly writes about in her biography. One of her associates who was helping found Teach for India argued that they needed to have a more comprehensive organization which sought to address social ills outside of education in other parts of the community to try to create this more holistic anti-poverty approach. But she said, no, if we fix education, it'll fix everything else. And so that's what they went with, which perfectly fits with the neoliberal playbook of guaranteeing supposedly equality of opportunity rather than equality of outcomes, which is just delusional, frankly.
Okay, so what does TFI look like on the ground? You visited their schools. What kinds of school days are children facing?
So there's one really interesting scene that was unfortunately edited from the story, and I'd be happy to share it. In one school that I went to in a neighborhood called Malad in Mumbai, it was rainy. It was near the monsoon season, I think. And this classroom didn't have proper windows, so rain was pouring into the classroom. And there was one girl I noticed who was very attentive and interested in learning, but she kept getting pelted by rain that she eventually got more distracted from the lesson because she had to sort of try to catch the rain water with a cup instead of paying attention to her Teach for India teacher. At the same time, there are other kids shivering, and one of them was feeling feverish. So when he told the teacher, she was like, oh, okay, put your head down. When kids in these classrooms get sick, what they tell them is, okay, just put your head down, because they have no nurses or anything they can give them. So they just tell the kids to just put their head down. That's apparently the solution for these sort of problems. Meanwhile, a bunch of students are crammed into this tiny classroom with desks, which look like they're purchased from the 70s. It's hard to hear because the rain is banging in and through the windows. But just really struck me how great the material deprivation that I was seeing was in front of me. It just could not be addressed by the Teach for India solution. No matter how excited or inspirational the teacher would have been or could be potentially, which they not that they necessarily were, there was no way that that inspiration could solve the sickness of the children or the rainwater falling on them. That requires a much more systemic approach to fixing schools. One of the kids who was shivering, I talked to him and I asked him what was going on. He said he was sick, but that his parents told him to just keep going to school and try to tough it out for a week because they couldn't afford medicine. He explained that they were looking for work currently. A lot of these kids in government schools come from the poorest possible backgrounds in the city. And you have to keep in mind, this is in Mumbai, which is the finance capital of India. It's the richest city in India. And yet they're not even guaranteeing proper facilities, proper teachers, proper classroom sizes, in violation of the law, actually, for the poorest of their students. And so a lot of students, as I mentioned, don't even have access to school beyond 7th and 8th grade, which is a problem that the teachers union in Mumbai is actually in court fighting right now.
And in your story, you recount a teacher who didn't speak the language of her students shouting in English, hoping that would help them understand.
Yeah, she was saying words like, interpret this, analyze this, and the students were just sort of looking on because they really didn't know what was happening. And so afterwards, I went up to one of the students and I asked him what he thought of the lesson. And he didn't know what I was saying at all because he didn't know English. And so one of the observers with me who spoke Marathi asked him, and he just said, good, and walked off immediately. So it wasn't quite the inspiring scene that I was expecting from their sort of web promotional materials. One thing that was kind of jaw-dropping was when I was in that classroom in Malad where I was talking about the rainwater pouring down on students and that sort of thing, I asked a Teach for India fellow, I asked her, so given this educational experience you've had, what do you think are the main structural problems that Indian students face in the day-to-day schools? And she looked at me straight in the eye and she said, pornography.
I said, what?
Porn? Are you kidding? She said, yeah, a lot of these kids just, they spend all day watching porn. And it's really bad. There's this culture of porn and violence in the villages they come from. And I was like, wow. So that's really the outlook that some of these people are coming into and even going out with, because she had been teaching for months and she still thought that a major setback to these students was pornography. I thought it was the rain falling on them.
Yes, and the untreated sickness. Oh, my
There's
God.
Actually a funny passage from Shaheen Mistry's book, The Sound of Teach for India, where she's talking about one of the exemplary fellows. And one of the fellows, while she was teaching, snakes literally come out of the ceiling. And the students are screaming, and she says, calm down, count to three. And that is the sort of example of a quality teacher, because she supposedly let nothing faze her and just continued on rather than dealing with the snakes that were invading the classroom at the time. So this sort of glorification of austerity, whether it be the teachers or the poor, is a large part of the Teach for India ideology.
Well, this is the grit the ed reformers love so much.
Exactly. One of the poor friends of Shaheen's in her biography is a woman who literally has to sandwich herself between her children because she has so little space to sleep in her home. And Shaheen, in the book, praises this resourcefulness, which is one of the values that's taught to students in the Teach for India program. But that sort of praise of resourcefulness doesn't also include a demand for a social movement to actually attack why that sort of striving under poverty needs to be addressed. It just sort of leaves it at that in and of itself and hopes that the poor will just be inspired by these missionary fellows to just overcome all the obstacles they face, which is clearly inadequate.
And before we started the interview, you were talking about the Gandhi-esque, I guess, of the adjective, ideology of the of TFI. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating. Teach for India, for its first class, would spend time supposedly, quote-unquote, connecting with the community. And they would do this by pairing up with poor families near Gandhi's ashram. So they would have fellows spend the day peeling banana chips, driving rickshaws, sorting out garbage, and things called inequity days. Some Teach for India fellows actually partnered with Teach First, which is the English branch of Teach for All, letting fellows try surviving below the poverty line for one day, sleeping on floors, using buckets of cold water for showers, that type of thing. And it's sort of that sort of poverty experiment for the day, I think, is interesting because it basically encourages Teach for India fellows to imagine that with this brief taste of poverty, this brief experience teaching in horribly underfunded classrooms, that they sort of can create like a spiritual bond almost with the communities that they serve, even if they leave after 2 years and go on to work in their government jobs. It almost obscures the conflicts that are inherent to Indian society, in which you have this extremely wealthy, often tech-driven class profiting tremendously while the bottom half or more than that is languishing in poverty. But like with the Gandhian ideology that they so strive to emulate, they don't seek to encourage social conflict or social movements that would demand more of the wealthiest of society or would demand social provisions through taxation or that type of thing. They're actually against it often. Instead, they hope that fellows will learn from this poverty, learn about how tough it is, and then go filter back into their ruling class positions and hopefully encourage a voluntary give back to the poor, which is actually very similar to what Gandhi advocated himself. He didn't call for the abolition of the caste system. He refused to necessarily even call for serious land reforms. He just wanted the rich to be nice to the poor, often not even in material terms. And so we see the fundamental weakness of this ideology in Teach for India, a nonprofit organization that seeks to have the beneficent rich realize that the poor exist and give back maybe a little to them rather than actually empowering democratic bottom-up social movements to take what is theirs through political action.
That was George Joseph, author of an article in the July 18 issue of The Nation on Teach for India. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a seasonally harmonious, if thematically dissonant, musical break. Thank you. was some of School's Out by Alice Cooper, one of two musical relics from the early 1970s on today's show. Next, Adolph Reed. The success of the Bernie Sanders campaign took almost everyone by surprise, except maybe Sanders himself. Though Hillary and the Dem establishment just wish he'd go away, he's revealed a large constituency for seriously social democratic politics in the U.S., especially among the young, which is no doubt why elites wish he'd go away. This is one of the most cheering developments in American politics in a long, long time. But how do we not merely preserve, but expand the campaign into a longer-term movement, and keep it from being snuffed out by the constricting banalities of electoral politics? Here's Adolph Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, and frequent guest on this show, with some thoughts. Welcome, Adolph. So now we know that Hillary is not going to get indicted, so it looks like she's going to get the nomination. The Sanders campaign surprised all of us, both by its intensity, longevity. What do you make of it? What lessons can we draw from it?
Well, I guess I should say this, too. I mean, to be clear, just to reinforce your comment, I think the campaign was wildly successful. But I want to stress that partly because I have noticed that there's a line out there coming from precincts in the ultra-left, precincts in the identitarian left, that want to parse the reasons for its failure. But as we know, none of us imagined a year ago that the campaign would be anywhere near as successful as it was. I think a lot of us, even people who were involved in it, just assumed that it would be over by March or the beginning of April. And, I mean, I think we should be concerned about the tendency to ventriloquize a really big and complex electorate or mass of voters. But I think, some things we can say about it are, one, there's a lot of pent-up frustration out there among working people. And I want to be clear, I want to lobby hard for a more expansive understanding of what we mean by the working class. And I mean expansive, in both directions, both to include, on the one hand, what some people would rather call a precariat, and on the other hand, a lot of people who would like to see themselves or others would like to see as part of a middle class. I think the latter tend to be much more like the working class with a mortgage.
And still just a couple of paychecks from disaster.
Well, no, exactly. That's exactly right. And I think it's time for us to kind of fight to take back a more political, economic, and sociological, sociological, I mean within the framework of political economy, right? An understanding of what class is and from that perspective, who the working class is. Anyway, I'll get off that soapbox for a second and to say I think the Sanders campaign showed that there are a heck of a lot of people out there, without regard to race, creed, color, or prior condition of servitude, who don't trust the mainstream of the Democratic Party, who I don't think that the main currents of dominant political discourse or the dominant discourses in American politics connect with the issues that they're concerned about in their lives.
And, of course, we've heard a whole lot of punditry about how the Sanders base was just a bunch of angry white men, any number of salon essays by Amanda Marcotte telling us that it's just not all that different from the Trump constituency. It's just angry white guys who just can't support the woman, et cetera, et cetera. Is that how you see the demographics of the Sanders phenomenon?
Well, I mean, that doesn't jive with my own experience. And, I mean, the problem with parsing the electorate is that you pretty much get to make up the numbers as you go along anyway. I mean, I think that what the Sanders campaign has done most of all is to show that there are people out there across the board who are concerned about, whose political concerns connect largely with the anxieties that they experience in their own lives. Stuff like not having access to dependable and affordable health care, like a minimum wage that's unacceptable, not being able to pay for college for themselves and their kids. Concerned about the impact of these trade agreements and endless wars. Look, and like I said, half, maybe two-thirds, maybe even four-fifths, maybe even five-sevenths of my academic discipline makes its living making up stories that are about attitudes that are extrapolated from public opinion surveys or exit polls. I never paid much attention to that stuff. And don't now, but what I can say is that just from talking to people in many states in connection with the campaign, you could see like a fairly broad responsiveness from all kinds of voters to the issues that the campaign raised. Now, you know, how much that turned into votes and why maybe it didn't turn into as many votes as some people would have thought could be the basis for another discussion. But again, like if you start out as I, and I think a hell of a lot of other people who were associated with the campaign did, with more modest expectations about what this thing could do, then you know, I think it was pretty wildly successful.
You've alluded to this a couple of times, but we should say explicitly that you did do some work with the campaign, so you're not completely disinterested bystander.
No, it's quite true. I'm not at all, actually.
Okay. All right. Back to of course, the Sanders campaign was criticized for a one-dimensional emphasis on inequality and, you know, class issues. And Hillary got off what she thought was a zinger, that breaking up the big banks won't end racism, which many of her followers nodded sagely in agreement with. What do you say to that?
Well, I thought it was a zinger, too.
A quite revealing way to respond to Sanders. But then I'd seen some stuff like that that was in some ways even more outrageous coming from some of the surrogates. I mean, for instance, I was in South Carolina in the last week or two before the primary there. And former SNCC icon John Lewis denounced the idea of free public higher education and free public goods and services across the board, and kind of sneeringly contended that it was sending the wrong message to the American people. They should have free stuff.
Yeah, you don't get free stuff in America.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Which is a statement of fact, but it shouldn't be that way for all time.
Well, no, exactly. And I mean, that's exactly the point, right? I mean, that it sets the boundaries of the thinkable in politics to fit with the boundaries of neoliberalism, right? And that's the horizon, right? A fully marketized world. But on the Clinton quip and the Krugman thing about horizontal inequality, I tell you what it brought to mind to me. I mean, this book, as you know, I've been working on like forever, but one of the patterns that I've noticed is that at those moments in at least my lifetime, I think the argument could be extended farther back in time, but I'm not in a position to do it. But at those moments when issues of stark economic inequality have come closest to breaking through the surface of the mainstream American politics, what we've gotten from elites in a response is some form of culturalism. Right? Like I was just telling my son a couple of days ago, Oscar Handlin wrote an essay and commentary in 1949. You know, Oscar Handlin, the great ethnic historian or historian of American ethnicity. So in 1949, Handlin writes an essay in commentary on groups and the ethnic groups and inequality and group mobility in America. That's a pan on the Cold War ideology. But what's striking about it is in 1949, he makes no reference to the New Deal. Right. So it's not like he's like, you know, a 21-year-old undergraduate, like in 2016, right? Like the New Deal was still around. And what we see that happens in the late 40s and early 50s with the defeat of that sort of CIO-led, left in insurgency in American politics, what we get as the next best kind of alternative is what Robert Self has referred to as homeowner populism, and an understanding of class as a category of culture and the kind of stuff that you buy, and a notion of racial inequality that's all about attitudes and prejudice and disposition. So what we get is a sense of well-being and understanding of class and understanding of racial justice that are completely disconnected from the workings of capitalist political economy. We see the same thing happening in the mid-1960s, where I think like the real punchline of the Moynihan report in 1965, the report on the Negro family, which has been rightly scored for playing the dozens on the black people and for other stuff like that. But the really insidious punchline, it comes in the introduction where Moynihan asserts that the way that we reckon inequality in America has to do with relations between ethnic groups, which is like a direct precursor to Krugman's horizontal inequality stuff.
You know, this reminds me of Kevin Phillips, architect of Dixon's Southern Strategy, saying that the key to politics is who hates whom.
Right.
And he was very much into cultivating that.
Right. Well, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And so that's what we have. And for me, that's one of the accomplishments of this campaign. If we take the longer view about what the significance of this campaign means and sort of back away from breathless speculation about taking back the Congress in 2018 or taking the White House like in 2020, and think about the capacities for actual movement building around a transformative political agenda, then I think one of the accomplishments of crucial accomplishments of this campaign is throwing into relief both the realities of economic inequality, which I think the campaign also shows didn't have to be, or that there are a lot of people out there who didn't have to be persuaded about the significance and the existence of economic inequality. But it also helps throws into relief, more importantly, the inadequacies of existing neoliberal kinds of responses to inequality. Taking like the Clinton-Krugman anti-racism stance, when I was out on the stump for the campaign and when somebody would ask in meetings about why the Sanders campaign hadn't done more to reach out to Black Americans, I would just say as a standard thing, I'd say, okay, well, so tell me how a $15 an hour minimum wage is not an issue that's pertinent for Black people, or how free public higher education is not an issue that's pertinent for Black people, or how a real national healthcare system and a decommodified healthcare system is not an issue that's important for Black people, and go right down the platform item by item. And for most people present, the response was like the nod along, because the reality is that all those issues are pertinent issues for Black people, and as a result, most Black people in attendance in the audiences would nod along. The question was more likely to come in a tendentious way from somebody who's either with the Clinton campaign or was hostile, like for one reason or another. But the fact is that I think that we can see, like I mentioned, John Lewis and James Clyburn a few minutes ago, I think that the Sanders campaign did a good bit to sharpen the contradictions within Black American politics as well.
I'm speaking with Adolph Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. A lot of Hillary people would say that's their clincher, that, you know, Sanders just couldn't get the Black votes. You know, it's interesting that a primary calendar that front-loaded the South, which was originally a DLC conception to skew things in favor of a more conservative nominee, actually skewed things in Hillary's favor because of the Black vote in the South. It, I don't know, it makes one rub one's eyes in confusion.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, I know. And in between, actually, the front loading of the primaries, of the Southern primaries, actually worked kind of against the DLC for Jesse Jackson. But the point was always what they thought, you know, was to skew, as you say, the race in favor of the more conservative candidate, which it did this time. And for the listeners who are interested, the piece that Cedric Johnson did in Jacobin on the complexities of the Black vote in South Carolina and elsewhere in the South, I think is really an important thing to read and consult. I mean, there are complicated reasons that Black voters voted for Clinton, and there are no single simple reasons either. Because in part, it's like a problem with an election-centered politics, right? I mean, one of the things that appealed to some of us anyway about the Sanders campaign was that it seemed to hold out the potential of being a boost for a political movement building undertaking. And it has been, and it is. But problem is that the reason that there would be a need for a boost like that is that progressive forces are so, well, I wouldn't say they're in disarray, but they don't counter very much and don't have very clear critiques and are inclined to keep doing the same things over and over again. And that's going to be, and those tendencies, right, the tendencies to pronounce the existence of a coalition of all of the other feckless and empty entities that all of the other progressive coalitions that have been called together in the last 20 years have founded on,
is going to be like an impetus that's got to be challenged and criticized and maybe organized around and underneath as we go forward.
And of course, the Clintons, both of them, have been running for president for like 40 years, and they've really made a lot of friends and networks in among black elected officials and black preachers. That it's really a formidable institutional leg up that they've had.
Oh, no, absolutely. And, I mean, that's like the, you know, clearest and the cleanest component of an explanation, because so much of what happens with electors is who has the capacity to turn out the votes. And by definition, I mean, those agencies and institutions are the ones that have the capacity.
All right, so the movement that looks to have been catalyzed or promoted by the Sanders campaign, how can we keep that from dissipating as November approaches? All the, you know, Trump is so horrible, you know, just hold your nose, vote Hillary, all that, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a great possibility for induced amnesia to set in. So how do we fight that?
Right. Well, boy, and that's a good question, Doug. Well, look, I think, first of all, that what one does for November lies in a different dimension from the movement building concerns, right? I mean, I think, from a pragmatic point of view, there really is nothing else to do except to vote for Hillary, right? But, you know, that only becomes a big to-do if you have an exaggerated sense of the significance of one's own vote anyway.
Yeah, people get so obsessed with something it takes about 5 minutes to do one afternoon in November. It's really remarkable. But,
yeah, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. And ultimately, like, on some level, when it comes down to a matter of, you know, taste and, like, existential choice. I mean, I couldn't vote for Gore in 2000, but, you know, I lived in Connecticut, and it was easy not to vote for Gore in 2000, right, and to vote for Ralph. You know, I would argue that this is a different moment. And especially with Republican control of Congress, even if they lose the Senate, which is kind of a long shot, I guess. So, but I mean, that said, we're going to be in the same position like on the Wednesday after the election that we were in on the Monday before the election, right? So, and I mean, the real challenge is to try to disconnect, the organizing from being driven by the election cycle.
But now, how important was the personality of Sanders to this?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's the kind of thing I would leave to the Slate people. Right. I never really saw this as being about Sanders. I mean, and I realize this is speaking for myself, but I mean, I saw Sanders and the campaign as like the booster rocket that could help us do stuff. And by the way, when I got involved with the campaign, it was partly when I decided actually to become more actively involved with the campaign is partly because I had gotten the sense that the key intelligence that was driving the campaign also saw this as at least as much a movement building project as an electoral one.
Well, yeah, well, Sanders himself never missed the opportunity to talk about the political revolution. He was clear it was not about just this particular campaign.
Right, exactly. Although I admit I never really liked that phrase. Because it's like vague and trendy, basically, and doesn't have enough content. So now people are tossing it around and for God knows what. But no, that's absolutely right. Sanders himself has been very clear from the beginning that this isn't just about him. It's a lot bigger. And I like the way that they're going in to fight over the platform now, because I think that also helps to message out concerning what it is or how we should think about what the forces that this campaign galvanized were primarily concerned with, right? And I think that the real thing is going to be being able to build out from the networks of people like in the labor movement and elsewhere who came together around this campaign and where and how people go next.
Yeah, now the campaign assembled quite a infrastructure in a short period of time, fundraising lists, institutional and personal connections among people who worked in the campaign. Can that be preserved in the coming months, or that just dissipate as November approaches?
Well, that's another really good question. I'd say two things. One is that I think a lot of it will dissipate, right? It's going to dissipate over time. because a lot of the motion around the campaign was caught up in the sort of exuberance of the idea and of the moment. It wasn't necessarily directed so much toward fighting for an agenda as it was toward the idea of the insurgency. But see, I think this is where the distinction between militants and the less attentive base of support, I suppose, would come in, right? Because the ideal would be that people who are seriously committed to trying to organize, to organize with the objective of building like a broader political movement that pursues a more transformative, political economic agenda, have also condensed and have come together and will be, you know, engaging in strategic discussions over coming months. And I mean, the hope is that, I mean, that's where, the emphasis is going to be that carries the thing past November.
Yeah, well, wonder about institutional forums. I suppose Jody Dean will tell us we need a party. That, you know, certainly a campaign is a particular institution that dissolves after a period of time. Is there some kind of party-like formation, something not party-like that we haven't conceived of? Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, as you know, there are some of us around this who are quite active in trying to create an alternative party. And as far as I know, almost all of us think that that's not the thing to think about at this time. I mean, I think at some point there's going to need to be some sort of formation. I'm pretty agnostic about what that formation ought to look like. The thing that I don't have a lot of confidence in is the tendency to put out broad calls for every different activist or activist-ist, more to the point, tendency in the country to come together to make a pronouncement. I mean, I don't think that'll be a way to go. I mean, and I know that that's a natural tendency among progressives, and I think it's an expression of one of the problems that we've had about the situation that we're in, which is that a lot of people don't quite want to come or haven't been able to come to grips with the actual depth of the difficulties that we're in, and the fact that we really need to start trying to build something from scratch, and that from that perspective, one thing the positive response to Sanders showed is that there is a base out there that we can try to connect with and to cultivate, but that I think that, you know, gatherings of the left and repositioning stacks of empty letterhead to form a new progressive alliance are, you know, ultimately just a waste of time and will give us more of the same. I think that the objective of our politics should be, and again, I think the Sanders campaign has been quite encouraging, like in this respect, the objective of our politics should be to find more ways to talk to people who we haven't been talking to and who don't necessarily agree with us about everything already anyway. This is one of the reasons that I think that the stuff about, the Bernie bros or the Sanders campaign appealing to disgruntled white men who are losing status is like so corrosive and dangerous, right? Because, right, well, first of all, that's most of the country, right? Again, I think that the response to Sanders has shown us that there is a much broader potential constituency out there. And, I mean, as I said before, one danger to avoid is mistaking the potential constituency for an actual constituency, which I understand that people with electoralitis often tend to do. But the campaign has shown us that there's a much broader potential constituency out there for us to try to connect with. And now the next 2, 5, 20 years are should be about connecting with, building on, and building within, and building out from that constituency to build a truly popular movement.
That's Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at Penn. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a song with no discernible political meaning, Big Eyed Beans from Venus, from Captain Beefheart. Till next week, bye.
Distant cousins, there's a limited supply. And we're down to the dozen. And this is why. Big-eyed beads from Venus. Oh, my, oh, my. Boys and girls, Earth people around the circle, mixtures of man alive. Big-eyed beans from Venus, don't let anything get in between us. Beam in on me, baby, and we'll beam together. I know we always been together, but there's more. Mr. Zoothorn Rollo, hit that long lunar note and let it flow.